This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com. How do we turn this diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation into, if you're going to come to this little diversity committee, the sole purpose of it is to put you at the tables that Harrison is at? How do we turn this diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation from checking the box to actually empowering people to take space?
Welcome back to another awesome episode of the Color of Money podcast. My name is Bo Minkiti. I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Imric Peace and Julia Lachey. We are excited to have an amazing duo with us today as we dig into some interesting and timely topics on our industry. And we're joined today by Harrison Beecher. I think some of you have had the chance to hear from Harrison Beecher before. We're excited to have him back on the podcast. He is the managing partner of Coalition Properties, one of the top sales teams in the Washington, D.C. area. He's also the incoming president of the D.C. State Association of Realtors and just wrapped up an amazing term as the chair of NAR's Meetings and Conferences Committee, which just kicked off with their amazing conference a couple of weeks ago. We are also joined by Tommy Choi, co-founder of Weinberg Choi Real Estate. He has been just an amazing force in real estate as well. He was a former president of the Chicago Association of Realtors, the first Korean American to serve in that role. He's very active with the Illinois State Association. He chaired the National Association of Realtors YPN Advisory Board and currently serves as the vice president of association affairs at NAR. Both these guys, I have had the privilege of knowing. They are great, great men, amazing fathers, and just good people. So really excited to be having this conversation with two sort of industry leaders as well as great people today. So thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here, man. Thanks, bro.
Tommy, weren't you just inducted into something new this year? Isn't that right?
Yeah, I don't know if it was a big deal, but I just got installed as the state president for the Illinois Realtors. Obviously, first Asian and Korean president for the state. I believe the first Korean state president in the country of Realtor Association.
Yeah. So when you say that's not a big deal, I'd like you to revise your statement, sir. That's a big deal.
That's a BFD, as I call it.
yeah.
It's like we got two members of Congress here or something, two senators
we
or something.
Do.
We got two of the representatives of the states.
Exactly what's going on. So my question for you all, what I wanted to talk about today was the state of real estate post-election. And here's what I mean by that. Many of us, most of us, all of us on this call today have done a lot of work in real estate championing diversity, equity, and inclusion. A lot of work was done into making our, not just our realtor association, but the real estate landscape in the country in general, more equitable for all people. There's been work gone into the different code of ethics and what's considered a violation, what's not considered a violation. Most recently, when I was on the diversity committee for NAR, there was a rule implemented that you have to have diversity training every 2 years in order to be a realtor. Also, in 2020, Article 10.5 was modified to include hate speech. And now, post-election, already, which the new president hasn't even taken term, there's a lot of conversation about getting rid of all of it. Guess what? We want to get rid of all of it. We never really mentioned it in the first place. We thought it was a good look, but we were just kidding. We really don't want to get rid of hate speech. We like hate. That's why, you know, and so we want to continue to do that. How do we navigate in this new post-election environment and continue the work that we've all done and continue to make real estate equitable given our current environment? That's a long-winded question, but that is my question.
I love that question. You know, I think the easy answer that's also the hard answer is that we just need more people of color in leadership positions in our industry, not just for the power of having the decision-making stakeholders, but also bringing those kind of perspectives. Because when now we're in this place where I'm finding, I'd love to know if all of you agree too, in our space, the real estate space, you know, everything was like DEI, gung-ho, whatever. And now it's turned into almost like it's like an HR checkbox. right? It's like, you know, hey, did you take your sexual harassment training and did you take your DEI training, right? And so it's becoming more, I feel like it's more like process than really purpose. And so I think we need to start to, you know, make sure that we're elevating our leaders. You know, like we were just talking about, I'm the 100th president of the state and it took 100 years to get here. It cannot take another 100 years further than my predecessor to come replace me, right? So it's what are we doing to create more opportunities for people of color in our industry to rise up as leaders? And my local Chicago, we kill it, right? Because we had to change the process and the system of how these leadership positions are vetted out and people are selected and chosen and asked. And now we have our leadership and board at a local level, the people are making decisions and from an advocacy policy standpoint, look like what the city of Chicago looks like, right? And so I think we need more of that across the board. Easy answer, but hard work to do, right? Because we need more advocates to continue to push on that.
Yeah, Julia, I don't know about you, man, but I am grateful when somebody like shows me who they actually are and what they really think. I feel like we had an environment over the last 3-4 years where as pendulum swing, there's both attention, resources, some resources towards diversity, equity, and inclusion, and saying the right things, putting infrastructure in place at specifically association side to get more folks to talk about different people and more folks to talk about diversity. But over the last couple of weeks and over these next few months, as individuals may be emboldened to say, I never really wanted to do that anyway, and if I feel like I don't have to now, I'd rather somebody say that. But in terms of how do you respond to that or what are we doing in response to it, if anyone is made to either feel unsafe, feel unwelcomed, feel any of these negative implications that we know come alongside racism, bigotry, xenophobia, all of the potential future negatives that may come along with the next administration, I need people to still speak up. Like Tommy said, as there are different folks in leadership that can actually advocate and give weight and give credence to folks that speak up and say, hey, this actually isn't right. This, you know, this is creating a space where I'm either feeling unsafe, feeling unwelcome, feeling whatever. I just want to say to folks, if they are encountering any of that and someone is bold enough to say it to your face, do it, you know, say the loud part out loud, you know, bring that energy, keep that same energy on and know that you do have folks in places of, if not just influence, you know, that have direct lines to the highest levels of leadership in our association that can bring those concerns up. Like, I'd like to believe, and Tommy, you tell me what you think, that if there are individuals from a state or local level that are saying different, harmful, negative, racist, whatever things, that we do have the mechanisms in place now where they can, you know, at least be brought up and be put on the path towards accountability. One of the things I worked on, Julia, in addition to the other titles, was NAR's Culture Transformation Commission, right? It was put together in response to some of the things that were going on with two presidents ago. And it talked about some of the things that were brought up in New York Times article. So I guess I'd like to say that there are people in the organization putting focus, effort, and thought towards mechanisms and the right systems to hold bad actors accountable. But I don't want folks to be discouraged and just be like, well, we're in a new administration, we're in a new environment where I can't even say anything like this. I don't want to just be resigned to like, this is how it's going to be, because I would hope that folks that are actually feeling that aggressively will say it with their chest and be very loud about it and be willing to see whatever repercussions come from what they say. So I don't know. I'd rather you tell me this is how you really thinking and feeling, like own it.
But do you think there would be actual repercussions for that?
Well, there's different levels. And Tommy, tell me what you think at the, because there's local, state, and national level. I know at the national level, there are still a part of Culture Transformation Commission was things that were put towards the board, recommendations about like how people can be held accountable at the different stages. But this is the challenge with like an entire United States of America, with an entire a federation under a big organization. How does that accountability bleed down? I just know we were kind of in the middle of a conversation about those mechanisms that have been out there. Okay. And at least for this next calendar year with Kevin Sears and, you know, some of the other folks on the exec team that I and Tommy know well, I'm confident that if I bring something that, you know, is important to me, passionate to me, of harm to somebody that I know, that I can be heard with it. I think Tommy may feel the same way. I'm relying more on the people I know in the higher up positions than just the all of the existing systems or the 75 or 80 or 90% of the rest of the organization that may feel that way. I don't know what you think, Tommy.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, it's all comes down really to the local level and, you know, the accountability being there. We have to hold each other accountable. To your point, when you see a bad actor, now at least there are, and I can't speak for every market, but, you know, there are channels and a system too now. How do you report that? What happens, right? What are repercussions on it? We can only hope that this, you know, I always say small hinges can swing big doors. And so, you know, we hope that this small momentum will compound into continually, you know, a bigger movement.
On another piece of this, a lot of cut times, the conversation, you talked about this a little bit, Tommy, like the conversation around DEI focuses on, can quickly focus on mitigation of negatives, which is a huge issue. And I think especially when people have a level of fear around maybe the environment we're in. But ultimately, we still have our hands on this thing called real estate and home ownership, which is the largest path to wealth for people of all backgrounds, colors in America. And so I'd be interested in your thoughts on how we create more of those hinges that can swing the doors, because in a time like this, it's probably all that much more important that there are people in positions to help, you know, day-to-day Americans buy and sell homes that support them in that homeownership journey,
yeah,
that can understand them and believe in their rights in that process. So how do we drive that? How do we combat from both sides? How do you both address the negatives, and how do you create more positives in an environment that we're in? That,
yeah,
some headwinds on that?
I think part of it is education is so important, and understanding, like, you know, for me, right, I'm a NAREB member, a NAREB member, an ARIA member. And when I go to these conferences, it's not just networking, but it's understanding, right? Understanding that, don't quote me on this, but in the next, I think, 10 years, 70% of the first time buyer pool, 70% of it will be Latino, you know, and it's, one, let's just look at it from like a business standpoint. You know, it's like, how are you going to educate yourself and prepare yourself to serve a community that's going to be a huge wave of homeowners, right? And especially in dominant Latino markets, right? So part of that, I think, goes to self-educating. And that's part of this whole people being like this fatigue of DEI. Everything has been spoon-fed to the people that need to hear the message. Now it's time for them to get off their ass and start to proactively find more education, right? And that's, I think, is the challenge in this, because I think when that happens from a, you know, entrepreneurial business standpoint, you want to be able to be prepared to serve other markets or grow your business. And in that, you're helping perpetuate, right, wealth generation through real estate, especially to underserved, you know, groups who have been disenfranchised in the past, and that there is a huge, you know, lag in that wealth building. So, you know, I wish I had the full answer on that, but I know what I'm doing to help do that. And you just hope that others will do that, not just from a, that's the right thing to do, but also just from a business standpoint, wanting to be able to be prepared to serve a large group.
That's a big question right there, because where we are right now, making sure that, I'm going to say our governing body, which is NAR at this point, that it doesn't drop off the table, that these conversations don't fall off, because that sets the tone for our industry. On the flip side of that, I believe that people, just like what you said, Tommy, they have to get the full effect that, you know, in about 15 years or less, the buyer pool will be totally different, yep, than what it is right now. And you're going to have, whether you like it or not, you're going to have to deal with that whole conversation of diversity. And I think one of the biggest fears, I could be wrong, is that people are afraid that when these people get in position, they're going to treat you like you treated them. So you probably should start treating them a little better now, whether you like it or not. It's coming. And I guess that you don't want that to really be the self-fulfilling prophecy. In that governing body, we have to just be really clear, really sure that we maintain that thought process, because we are a public entity.
You know, what we do next to educate, to prepare, to like help folks. I got the chance to go out to North Dakota for their state convention, North Dakota, South Dakota combined state convention.
That was interesting.
very interesting, great people. And of all the classes that they could have me teach, right, to be their keynote speaker and teach, they chose for me to do a class on leaning in to diversity, equity, and inclusion and how it can help your business. Their state president's a friend and picked that. And of all the things, this whole menu, I was like, oh, that's, you pick, okay, all right. And I'll tell you, from that class, it was a 3-hour first CE, so people had to sit. I was pleasantly surprised at the attention, at the curiosity that people came with, instead of just like, you know, I don't want that. And there were people in that room. And again, diversity in the Dakotas is different than other places because it's more like Latinos, natives, like they've got like their others are not necessarily Black, Asian, like in other places. By the end of that class, there was space for a woman to speak up that was like, hey, some of these other groups that we talk about that I was challenging the group. She's like, I'm actually a member of this group. I am native and Latino, and I've been hanging out with y'all for this long. And I don't even think y'all knew that about me. So I tell that story to say, if we can make space where people are kind of choosing to, ideally, or in some cases forced to, interact with a group that they're identifying as other, it does a couple things. Like Tommy said, it helps identify when there's a business opportunity to serve this community. I am better prepared to serve that community, one, like from my pockets. And two, all these other things I was saying, or that bigger narratives are creating, that we're that different, or they and them or something else, are kind of dispelled. So like, that gives me hope from an association standpoint, because I wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for Nick, who's the state president, that wanted me out there. And then I think with Micah, that also helped select this class that they wanted us to bring. There are certain people in leadership, even in extremely, you know, stale, male, and pale spaces, that say like, no, I want to bring this conversation here to our people, even if they're a little bit uncomfortable with it. And I think it had a positive result. And that's what gives me a little bit of hope about like some of the like local, state, and smaller things that hopefully will build up to, you know, more happening nationally.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Harrison, part of it might have been just the amazement of how well you articulate.
Shut up, Emmerich.
Emmerich being crazy. Shut up. Emmerich's got to do that.
Part of it. How you're so articulate. Oh my gracious. Let me listen a little closer.
I guess I'm a more acceptable vessel for this message than others, but they, you know, they heard it.
Yeah. It's a really interesting question though, because it's something you said earlier, Harrison, like, I want to know where people really stand. We all live in these echo chambers of our own thinking, right? And, you know, I think for some people, I think hopefully elections, that's a wake up call. It says, hey, look, people in their heart don't buy what you're selling as a policy. And I don't actually think that this industry, this country, actually creates real interaction and real progress in that, in our real diversity. That happens in relationship between human beings. And we can make people take a class. We can put a policy out there. You could decide what's hot today and what's not hot tomorrow. But at the end of the day, we're human beings interacting with other human beings. And the story Harrison just told about a human relationship he had with another leader, all the more reason why we need more diversity amongst our leaders.
Yeah.
Who then created a space to create another human relationship between people that moves hearts and minds. But I think part of the DI backlash is policies don't move hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. Relationships do.
Yeah.
And when we shut down conversation by advancing one agenda or the other, we don't actually create the opportunity and the space for people from different perspectives to come together, which is actually what true diversity is.
I love that, Bo. I was going to say the same thing about going all the way back to Tommy's first comment about just having more people in leaderships and not necessarily pushing any particular agenda, but being engaged in the conversation. Most recently, I've been telling people I'm going to write a book called I Met a Guy on a Plane, because I always come back off a flight and say, I met this guy on a plane. Literally, almost every flight now for the last couple of months, I've met a guy on a plane. I sit next to them. We talk about their business.
It's all that first class flying you're doing, Julia.
I was going to say, we are in first class, okay?
Yeah, yeah. The guys who I meet on my flights are not the same guys you meet on your flights, okay?
I know.
Two different guys.
But wait, no, because I have been blessed to, sometimes it's comfort plus, it's not always perfect, but I sit next to these guys and they talk to me about their businesses and we engage in really good, deep conversations. One guy, when we got off the plane, we had a 2-hour conversation about his hunting and his properties he owns in the middle of nowhere in Colorado, his land that he owns, these cabins he remodeled. And we get off the plane, he chased me down in the airport and said, wait, I got to get your information in case we can do business. This man would never speak to me in any other circumstance other than I happened to have my computer open and I had an economic model up for my real estate brokerage, and he was interested. And we engaged in a conversation, and he wanted to do business. His name was David. The next flight was Clinton. Clinton owned the only automotive, he had the only license for automotive in what was it, South Lake, Texas. And we engaged in a conversation of how he sold his business on seller financing. And we engaged in all these conversations, and we built these relationships. Now, if I went to teach a class at his automotive business or at David's veterinary company he owns about diversity, equity, I can guarantee you they are not interested in anything I'm having to say. But what they are interested in, and none of these guys ever would call themselves privileged, certainly not racist. They would never identify themselves as that. And maybe neither would I, but what they just don't, they're ignorant. In some of their conversations, I picked this up because some of the things they're saying were just ignorant to other people's worlds and perspectives. They are not engaged in diversity conversations. So I truly believe that the solution is exactly what Tommy said, having more people who are skilled in leadership. And we're joking about Harrison talking so articulate, but it gets in places and it opens up hearts and minds because they do want to engage in a conversation with Harrison. So even diversity committees, I hate to say this, but I'm not an advocate for the typical diversity committee. If your diversity committee is not creating leaders that are going to go forth into the other committees, I don't want to be on anybody's diversity committee. I want to diversify committees. Right. I want to be on the government affairs. I want to be on the what all the stuff Harrison does, where you're actually building relationships with people who aren't going to come to your DEI class. OK, but how do we spend more time doing that? How do we turn this diversity, equity and inclusion conversation into, if you're going to come to this little diversity committee, the sole purpose of it is to put you at the tables that Harrison is at. It is for Tommy to be the first Asian state president ever. How do we turn this diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation from checking the box to actually empowering people to take space? Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit HomeTeam.com to learn more.
You know what? That's a combination of things. Number one, the only reason why Harrison and Tommy are in the rooms because they said they wanted to be in the room. They volunteered to be in the room. I believe that's an opportunity for us sometime in our communities to step up and volunteer to be in the room. That's a part of it. The other part is that we just have to know and not be intimidated by the room. And the way we become less intimidated by the room is when we see other people like us in the room. Because when you're the only one in the room, it can be a little intimidating because you don't know how your comments are going to be taken. It goes both ways. However, the big deal is that, you know, when that room is there, the people in that room have to at least be open to a conversation.
You know, the other thing with it, you know, Emmerich, I'll add is also, and this is where when you have some color in a room, now it's, you know, part of what my biggest, you know, intention when as I continue to grow in my leadership journey was, hey, we can't have this. A lot of organizations, they are just like, well, you know, that just like completely white are just like, well, you know, no one of color is applying. No one's coming to us, right? It's we're open. But it's like, no, like that's the worst mindset. Where are you going out to seek out diversity? And that goes down to being intentional on where you host your events, right? There was a point where in Chicago, all of our events would be in downtown, right? In River North, Magnificent Mile. That's on the north side of the city, right? Anyone coming from the south side of the city, that's almost an hour through traffic, right, to come. So why would I even come to this event? Let's have it, if you want to be intentional, let's have an event in the south side, the west side of Chicago, the northwest side of Chicago, in different communities that represent our membership, because that's going to make it easier for someone, like to your point, Emmerich, say, okay, now I'm going to go to this event because it's literally down the street from me. And right. Let's see what opportunities exist there, right? So part of that also comes from, and that's the culture piece of organizations having the mindset of like, no, they should come to us. Like, this is downtown. We have a beautiful building, yada, yada, yada. No, no, no. go out into the community.
I totally agree with you, Tommy. And I think that's so important from an institutional standpoint that we start to think about that stuff. And I'm very interested to hear from the two of you, because I know for Emmerich, I know for Julia, and I know for the two of you, you weren't always invited into the room. It wasn't always easy. You did have to drive, do a lot more than drive through an hour of traffic. And the answer is when you're part of the first became the first because they didn't wait for an invitation. And I'm interested in that mindset. What would you say to others who are sitting back saying, that room looks uninviting to me? I don't yet see the representation of myself and the people in that room. But maybe I want to be in that room. Maybe I'm interested in what's being done there. Maybe I have something to offer to that conversation. What made you do the extra drive, make the extra effort to get in the room? And how would you advise others to think about that if they're sitting a little bit on the sidelines going, hey, question, should I make that move? Should I not? It doesn't feel super welcoming to me. And it's going to feel even maybe less welcoming nowadays. Mm-hmm. How do I actually get over that fear? Because the reality is someone had to go first. If the room was all one way and it changed, someone had to go first.
You and I have this in common, Bo. The PWI experience in university created a lot of chances for me from age 18 to be the one, the only, the, you know, representative for the blacks in the room. Like that, it's something I had to do and be comfortable with. And I chose to go into some of these spaces because, you know, between different mentors, between other people I saw in my life that had achieved a level of success that I knew I wanted, I knew they were there. And it was like not even understanding all the details, say, hey, if I want something close to what they have, then I want to be here. Is it going to possibly be uncomfortable? Am I going to be judged? Am I qualified to be here? Am I going to have imposter syndrome? All those things, yes. But it was for me kind of the end goal that I at least had a little bit of insight to that encouraged me to be there. And then now I look at somebody like my business partner, Keith James, who y'all know has been on this space a lot, getting him to be confident and sitting on stage in front of primarily or all white crowds when we know what he is capable of. We know his skill. We know what he's got. But he still had that voice in the back of his head that they're going to be judging me. They're going to disqualify me, whatever. It took like the reps of him getting up there doing it and then people receiving what he's sharing and putting out there because it is brilliant. It is amazing. He needed that positive reinforcement before he could be comfortable with raising his hand to do it more and get on stage. So, Bo, I think it takes, you know, for that first person that goes, an acknowledgement of like what being in the room may actually get you in the future. And then once you're there, like I said, we are in rooms now. What are you doing to actively encourage and show that roadmap or explain to the person coming behind to say like, yo, like get here first. You're qualified. Like, look at me, trust me. If I'm valid and legit, and I say you're valid and legit, you are valid and legit, and you are, have so much to contribute more than whatever that voice in your head is saying that you can't. And last thing I'll say, Bo, before I transition, you taught me, and I saw this as an example, production and bringing something to the table from a personal accomplishment standpoint, right, earns you seats and spaces where you may not have been before. So for folks like on their growth journey and getting somewhere, like what are you actually doing from an outstanding production standpoint, be it in recruiting, in sales, in whatever, like what is your thing that you're doing that's exceptional that removes one of those ticks away that the folks might have against you and say like, oh, you're not XYZ, because you can have that confidence like, no, I actually am, or I'm working towards, I'm exceptional, I'm producing something in this space. Production is like an equalizer in spaces that are not welcoming to different folks. Because if I got the production, if I got the like actual receipts, then that kind of quiets anything that you would try to say against me. So, yeah. You know.
It's really interesting. You made me think of, this is a side note, but you made me think of, there's this amazing book I just read, you know, Harrison's alma mater, but there was a great basketball coach, John Thompson there. And he wrote a book called I Came as a Shadow. And in this book, I Came as a Shadow, he talks about the role he played in so many great basketball players' lives coming through Georgetown and the role he played in the city of Washington, D.C. There was a huge overlap between sort of the cultural history of Washington, D.C. and what he was doing. And, you know, he was at the forefront of a lot of changes in the NCAA. And he says, hey, people think of me as a crusader for racial justice and for social justice. But make no mistake about it. I was only able to do that because we won basketball games at Georgetown. And so I think that this is not fair. It is not right. I'm not advocating for a culture of exceptionalism, but I am saying the reality of it is one of the dangers of a professed DEI agenda with people who are not actually bought into that agenda is it lulls people into thinking that participation is an entitlement And in this country, it's been made very clear it's not. And so if we're waiting for someone to come get us, that doesn't mean institutions shouldn't come get us and shouldn't put the event closer to us. But if you're waiting for that to happen, you may be waiting a long time, because if nothing's changing about how people think and how they feel, the only way that's going to change is if you actually have some platform to stand on that allows you to then engage. And I think there's so many people of color in our industry who have an amazing platform to stand on, who actually have the capacity, the capability, the professionalism, the production, and they're sitting there at that moment with the actual, with the winning record, with the John Thompson winning record, and they don't know that they have the ability then to participate and speak out and make a difference. And I think the two of you are such great examples of that. You were amazing at this business. You've done amazing things in this business. But you're also, the flip side of the imposter syndrome is knowing when your receipts allow you to push the envelope so that things actually can change. And I think you two have been experts at doing that.
That is so good. I think that is so incredibly true, that otherwise they do become a DEI hire. You can't call Tommy and Harrison a DEI hire as if it was just to hit a quota, because like Harrison said, they got receipts, right? Like they literally have done the work, put in the work, and didn't wait for invitations. I know they just showed up places like many of us do. And I think that's important. But what happens when you do that so long, and we've been doing this so long, all of us have been doing this so long, right? At what point do you get tired? Because I'll tell you what I saw at the NAR NXT conference. That was a great job you put on, Harrison. I'll tell you what I saw of all the Black women that I knew that had been championing these things and have receipts and were well qualified. Every last one of them, and I mean every last one of them, with the exception of Marky, was like, you know what I'm gonna do? This is no longer Black Girl Magic season. This is Black Girl Sit Down Because I'm Tired season. I'm over it. And so many people are like, guess what? I'm over it. We did all this work and it's not really doing. In fact, they're trying to undo all the hard work. So what happens for the people who did show up, who do have receipts, who have been doing this, and now are like, you know what? You can have it. Now what?
I think Black women earned that break. I felt that energy, Julius. It was like, we take the rest because we just put in the work, right? It's like that. I was joking. I put that meme up of the Popeyes woman after she had been cooking the chicken, just leaning back, like just tired. Like, yes, yeah. It's okay to be that. It's okay to be that tired for a second and rest. But then you look back around at the folks who you care most about and who may feel that same level of like either dejected, you know, frustrated, sad, whatever. And you ask each other, like, what can I do to support you? What can we do to support each other? And in this next phase, in any space that I do still have a microphone, influence, whatever, actively pull you along to be together in what we're still doing in the industry, right? Like, but the space of time was needed. And then the reconnection, recollaboration of like saying, we're going to stay together in this and figure it out. That's where I think I'm at.
That's going to be the biggest challenge, because like Julia said, when you're at that place right now, where you had the Black Girl Sit Down, the challenge is that now you really got to roll up. You got to double down on some things, because what was covert will become overt. And it's a different fight, because you have a license to act that way. And I was just talking to someone yesterday, and they work downtown, and they're GS15. And this is just an idea. His manager told him, I was sent here to remove the tar from this organization. And in the meantime, 2 days before that, he had just gotten written up for a plan that he put together with a 14-day suspension. He had never had a write-up in 18 years. So that's the conversation that is coming around.
One of the things that it really hit me just in life, in this season of life for me, like the election was some kind of this cherry on the top of, there are things like, I expect people to have different perspectives, different politics, different stuff. But there are certain base human values that I've always thought we as Americans share, we as human beings share. There are things that are sort of core to humanity, right? In my like struggling to process this across so many different experiences that were all lining up, that didn't seem like okay, I expected there to be us to have different views, different places, different politics, but I didn't think we disagreed about like deep human decency, right? And the day after the election, I get in the car and I'm taking my middle son, who's super sensitive, to school. He doesn't really know. One of my sons is in a very conservative school. One's in a very liberal school. So one son's telling me how everyone's happy that Trump won. And the other one's talking about, you know, the world's falling apart. And we're having this conversation. And it came down to this conversation that stuck with me. which was this lesson that we talked about in that car ride, was there's a difference between popularity and character. There's a difference between popularity and values. And when your values and your value, not just your values, but your value, which I think was a lot of this experience that I could only imagine and think I understand that Black women went through, when your values and your value is that question in an election. An election is a popularity contest. It is not a statement about value, and it's not a statement about character. And so as we move through a time where it may not be popular or convenient, as Dr. Martin Luther King said, to be seen and champion diversity, there's a question of, is it really our values? And are we going to let, you know, a broad sweeping group of people that don't know you define your value and define your character? I think that's where it sort of the rub comes in. How do we actually hold true to things that we believe in an environment where they're no longer convenient or popular? And that is exhausting. And I think that's what Joe's point. It's exhausting. But it's also necessary, because if we define our value by what happens to be popular at the time, we put our own uniqueness in the hands of others.
Well, it almost makes you a commodity at that point. Are you trading your values for position? Are you trading your values for position? And it's only worth what it's worth in that market. And that's why I say commodity. It's only worth what it's worth at that point in time in that situation. I believe that one of the things that in that space boat, we have to understand that our values and our value are the same, no matter who's there and no matter what space that we're in. The only thing that we have to do is we have to be able to endure the pain of somebody telling you it's not worth what you think it is. That's where the issue comes in.
But Black women and everyone that fought hard, like, your value is still there. Those values do still matter. My kind of aha moment the days after Bo, and even bringing it back to real estate, was realizing that while there are things that are in terms of priorities right in front of my face that are really important to me, the economic pain that people were feeling, the fear, the lack of exposure and knowledge that they had, all weighed more than these other things that I thought were really important. And my echo chamber that I thought was big, my bubble that I thought was huge, was actually a lot smaller than it is, right? Like that's, mm-hmm. And that's, again, we are blessed to live big lives and interact with a lot of different people. So I had like confidence. I mean, I feel like I had, you know, like, oh, kind of like, I don't know what's really gonna happen, but hey, I feel like most people, yeah, we get it. We're on the same page. And I'm like, damn, like I'm really not as connected or, you know, understanding of a wider swath of not just, you know, the communities I interact with, but our greater nation. But to Emmerich's point, like those values and the value of people who are questioning it now has not changed. I just think we got to like remind each other, even if the majority said it didn't matter to them or wasn't as important, that it is still important. It does still matter.
I have one final question really about all of that. Circling back to the guy I met on the plane, whether it was David or Clinton or any of them, there was one common denominator. And there always is a common denominator. And that common denominator is that they own land. They all own real estate, right? And not just small real estate, they own land, acres. And so for us, and I think what I identify with them when I'm having these conversations is the difference between you and somebody else really smart that I know that I met yesterday is you own land, but there's been a history of them having different levels of access to do that. Even one of the guys and his wife, they were like, oh, come out to our place in the middle of nowhere. It's like, no, sir, you don't even understand that I can't do that. Like, I can't come out to the middle of nowhere. No, sir. But how do we, as we're all real estate professionals, we're having this conversation in the realm of real estate. The difference between me and those guys also, they paid for first class. I was upgraded. Okay. I'm always upgraded. I'll never pay for it. And the difference between me and them is that they own land that I don't own. So we all work in the landscape of real estate. How do we use our positions now, your position, Tommy, as the state president, your position, Harrison, and I can never even keep up with your positions. You have so many, you know, how do we use these roles to help people of color? This podcast is called The Color of Money. How do we use these roles to help people of color acquire land? That is the difference between me and David and Clinton.
Yeah.
I don't have that.
That's such a great question and observation. I agree. And you know, something like, you know, in my market in Chicago, I hear agents say all the time, and usually it's white agents saying, ah, there's just not enough inventory. There's no inventory in the city. And I always have to correct them and say, no. There's no desirable inventory. There's plenty of inventory on the south and west sides of Chicago, but your clients don't want to buy there. And ultimately, where I am from an advocacy standpoint as the face of the state of Illinois, even when I was in Chicago, was advocating with, you know, elected officials and business owners that, hey, what changes desirability in neighborhoods creating more inventory? Well, that's commercial corridors, right? The reason why no one wants to buy as much residential, you know, maybe in the south side is because there's no grocery stores. There's no retail. Mm-hmm. We need commercial corridors. And once we can build that, now the opportunity for people in the community can actually buy the land and be homeowners are there and own property versus outside investors coming in, right? It all starts with that, right? So that for me, I know it's a bigger play, but that's what I've been focused on for the last almost 10 years now since I've been in these leadership positions. Because now city council knows who I am, because mayors know who I am, because community leaders know who I am, we're all working together to create more of that. So then there is more access for wealth building in real estate.
I can keep mine brief, Julius, just that using, you know, kind of whatever platform we have to draw that line Tommy was talking about earlier to creating more opportunities for a wider and diverse buyer and investor pool is in the financial best interest of a city, is in the financial best interest, quite frankly, of banking institutions, right? Like a world where there are more qualified people that can participate in these markets and be consumers and be taxpayers and all that is a good world, is a positive world. But sometimes, as Bo knows from doing a lot of the private-public partnerships and other things, it can come with some other layers of, in terms of preparation and getting there, but that extra effort can make sense. So, you know, how do we impact it? Wherever we have the voice, wherever we have the opportunity to weigh in and explain, a little bit of extra effort, a little bit of extra thought can equal significant dividends and returns on all sides and do good and do what it should at the same time. Like that they can and are all connected, but it takes people that, you know, have both the creativity, the thought, and the desire to make all that happen and make that mesh where it would not just happen naturally. Like it wouldn't just happen naturally because folks, you know, at the table and decision makers don't default to that, right? Because it's a more challenging path.
I so love that you guys brought us back to community development and economic development. And thank you, Julius, for bringing us back. I just want to thank you guys. I mean, I think part of the moment that Julia articulated is about the heaviness on our leaders in this moment. And I think I'm so grateful that we can look out in our industry and see that the future is bright for our industry and that there are folks like Harrison and Tommy leading the way. And I hope that for all of our listeners, that gives you hope and gives you energy that there are people out there working on your behalf, working on our whole industry's behalf, and bringing new perspectives, new ideas, and new efforts that can move us all forward.
Follow the Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not KWRI and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.